The Google Podcast app is going away in April. Right now, I want you to take a look at the podcast app you're using right now. Maybe it's time for a new one. Check out podcastapps.com and try a new one for free right now. That's podcastapps.com.
My name is Stuart Reynolds, but I'm probably better known to you as Brittlestar, a fully grown man who makes videos on the internet for a living. And I'm ready, but slightly trepidatious, to start digging deep.
Welcome to Digging Deep, presented by ZenBooks and Abacus Data. I'm Mark Sutcliffe, and I'm on a quest to learn from the best. It seems like everybody now is in the business of producing content. Even if you're just sharing an occasional post on LinkedIn, you're in the content business. And lots of people and companies are doing so much more than that, releasing videos, crafting strategic tweets, and sharing visual content on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook to build their brands, attract more followers, and sell more products. So I wanted to figure out, what does it take to make a video go viral? How do you build up a following for your content? And there's really no better person to talk to about that than Stuart Reynolds. You may know him better as Brittlestar. Under that handle, Stuart has been an absolutely prolific producer of online content, releasing videos that make people laugh, but also carry a message. Sometimes during the pandemic, that message has been about public health. Other times, it's been to draw attention to a particular sponsor or client. And Stuart has generated an enormous following. His videos have been watched more than 600 million times across various platforms. And in 2017, a video campaign that he did for KFC was the most popular branded video content in the world. So what does it take to produce the kind of content that gets people's attention, that's sticky? And just who is the person behind the brand Brittlestar? Well, in this episode, we're going to find out. Stuart explains how, at the age of 43, he turned making videos into a way to make a living. He admits that while luck definitely plays a role, you just never know what's going to take off and what's going to be a dud. It also takes focus, humility, and the ability to stay out of your own way. Luck gets you in the door, and it can open the door, but it doesn't keep you in the room. So what exactly keeps you in the room? One thing that Stuart talked about a lot is that you can't rail against your success. We're going to get into exactly what that means. We'll also talk about being fluid and adapting to new technology. Although it can sometimes look easy, obviously it's not. I think we all know that. Stuart tells us about all the work that we don't see someone like him doing that leads to success. He takes us back to the first Vine video that he posted in 2013. Getting back to why you need to be fluid about technology. Vine, of course, is not around anymore. And he describes the challenges of monetizing social media. He reminds us not to waste our time. But he points out that it can be too easy to get lost in the idea of exchanging our time for money. He also talks about acknowledging anxiety and the importance of prioritizing your own mental health, especially as the pandemic changes how we live and how we consume content. He has some very specific advice when it comes to comment sections, and I know that's probably not going to make the online trolls very happy. And he stresses the importance of using entertainment, using humor, to get your audience's attention so you can deliver your message in the strongest way possible. We will also learn which Canadian celebrity has been telling people they're related to Stuart, and why he's pretty sure that the fact that he got invited to the White House is proof that the world ended in 2012. This conversation is a lot of fun, but it's also very informative. I think you're going to get a lot out of it. One last thing before we get started, I'd really appreciate it if you would subscribe to this podcast and post a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and share it with some friends. And if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Dig. It's a very quick 2-minute read. It has 5 really useful lessons that you can apply to your life and to your work. And lots of people are reading it every week and they're enjoying it. So please give it a try. You can subscribe at letsdigdeep.com. That's letsdigdeep.com. Now, let's start digging deep with Stuart Reynolds, better known as Brittle Star. All right, Stuart, Brittle Star. I don't know what to call you, but welcome to Digging Deep.
It's a common occurrence. It's a common thing. People don't know what to call me anymore. It's fine. I'll answer to anything.
Okay. Is it okay if I call you Stuart? Because I've always, I don't know why, but I've always been uncomfortable with nicknames for people. Like, I have friends who have, you know, nicknames, and I always just call them by their name because I feel like goofy calling them by the nickname. I don't know why.
Yeah, but you'd have a problem with like The Edge from U2. You'd be No, it's totally, what's really weird about the name Brittle Star is that there's people who know me and have known me from well before this all happened. And they just now refer to me as Brit.
Brit.
Oh, it's like, okay, whatever.
So it's a short form of your nickname.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's a nickname of a nickname.
Yeah. Brittle Star to Brittle to Brit. And then I'm sure it'll just be B eventually for, we'll find out. You can call me Stuart. That'd be lovely.
So we'll talk more about the name coming up because there's a story behind that, obviously. But let's start with our rapid fire questions and get to know you a little bit. So what would you say is your fondest childhood memory?
My fondest childhood memory, I mean, there's lots of them. I've been pretty fortunate, but I would think my fondest childhood memory would be singing into our umbrella stand while my parents and grandparents cheered when I was about 3.
Okay. So were you always kind of entertaining the family? Were you a bit of a showman?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that was less a case about me wanting to stand out rather than me wanting to keep up. Like, one thing about sort of Scottish backgrounds is that there's usually a sing song when people get together, and you got to have your sort of your party piece ready. So you got to have your song ready. You've got to have like a joke ready. You've got to have a story ready. You've got to have something to entertain, and it's going to be your turn to be in the spotlight. So I felt like, I think back to those times when I'd use our umbrella stand, which was this really cool sort of small, looked like a little microphone stand. And I would pretend it was a microphone, and I would get, you know, applause and cheers, and I'd be like, yeah. And I think that was probably pretty infectious.
Yeah, nice. Nothing like that, especially for a kid, for a young lad.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I guess I should be calling you Stuart then, not
exactly. Stuart. Stuart. Yeah.
Who was your hero when you were 10 years old?
Henry Winkler. Easy.
The Fonz,
yeah. And what's really cool about that is that I've since had a chance to talk to him and also share a picture of me when I was about 10 wearing my Fonzie A shirt.
Okay.
Which he said I was the coolest. So there you go.
Nice.
It's been the claim. It's been acclaimed. So
very nice. But did you ever watch like Happy Days when you were older? And because I that was my big show for a period of time, and then I watched it like when I was an adult, and I couldn't believe how horrible it was.
Well, it's just, I mean, it's funny because I try and we did that once with you remember the show Emergency with the fire station and all that kind of stuff, and it was great and it was really exciting. And I remember when our first son was born and we were staying up, like getting up to do, you know, 2 o'clock feedings and stuff, and it was on the television. And I said to my wife, I was like, oh, this is great. And she was unfamiliar. And I was like, this is a phenomenal, just watch, the intro is so exciting. The intro went on for like 8 minutes and we're like, just get out of the station. Oh my God, get in your trucks by now. The fire has burnt out.
Yeah. Back when TV shows had intros, right?
And exactly.
So what did you think you were going to be when you grow up? Because obviously it wasn't this.
No, I thought I was going to be a singer. And then a singer first. And then I thought I was going to be a coroner. And then I realized that not every coroner got their own TV show like Jack Klugman. So I was like, that's out. Not interested.
What is your life story in 6 words?
My life story in 6 words is probably worked very hard to avoid working. That's exactly it. I will spend hours to find a way to save time to do something, which is foolhardy. But that's just the way I work. So it's fine.
Yeah. But that's the way you describe that, though, work very hard to avoid working.
Avoid working.
Sounds, when you first said it, I thought it was sort of like, you know, to follow your passion instead of have a job, like that kind of.
Kind of. Know? I mean, it's kind of, I mean, that's essentially it. Because I've been so involved in music my whole life, you know, as you're a teenager really involved in music, your parents are like, yeah, but what are you going to do for money? What if this doesn't work out? What are you going to do for money? And so you have to try to find ways to make what you want to do make money. And so that leads to, you know, like for me, it meant writing radio jingles and stuff like that. And it's you know, this is, I will work very hard to avoid working. I'll work very hard to avoid getting a real job.
Yeah. And so far, so good.
Knock wood.
Yeah.
Exactly.
For what do you feel most grateful?
I feel most grateful for the fact that I'm able to get up in the morning and just decide what to create. I mean, I have a schedule and there's things I have to do. However, I don't really know what I'm doing next week or what I will create next week. And it really hit me with, I watched an interview with Nick Rhodes and John Taylor from Duran Duran. And they were doing an interview, it was a live stream thing, they were just chatting. And I thought, man, I said to my wife, Shannon, man, it would be so great if I could just get up and just decide what to make. And I went, wait a minute, that's what I do. That's my life. So that, I'm very grateful for that.
That's awesome. What has been the best year of your life so far and why?
This year, because I'm not dead. I think that the older you get, you start to realize that every year is like, all right, cool, another one. Another chance to either screw things up or have more fun or both. This year, because I'm not dead. That's my answer.
Okay. I hope you say the same thing next year.
Me too.
Yeah. What's been the toughest year of your life so far?
Toughest year of my life was 2008 to 2013. It was a very long year. It was awful. It was terrible. Our business had collapsed and we were, by 2013 rolled around, we were in dire fiscal straits, notice on the house door and all that kind of stuff, like just terrible. So that was probably the worst year of my life.
Yeah, the worst year, five years in a row.
5 years, exactly, exactly.
Yeah. What one person has had the greatest impact on your life?
Well, my wife, Shannon, for sure, absolutely. Because she is a foil, she is a support. She's a bit of a dick, that's probably all good for me. So
that's a first. I haven't had any guest describe their spouse that way
as
before.
A bit of a dick.
Yeah.
Thank God Shannon doesn't listen to podcasts.
Yeah. what is the most important lesson that you've learned that you would share with other people?
Don't rail against your own success. I think that that's sometimes you sort of get in your, you start working in one direction and you might find yourself getting successful in a slightly different direction. And sometimes your automatic reaction to that will be to fight against it and to kind of subdue that success or to sort of tamp it out. And you shouldn't. You shouldn't rail against, just take any success you get and build it into the next success.
Okay. I like that. What would people be most surprised to learn about you?
I am like socially anxious. If you put me in a room full of people, just to mingle around, I'm terrified. I get uncomfortable and I have to either do one of two things. I have to switch into extrovert mode where I become a bit of an idiot, and that usually requires alcohol. Or you have to hand me a microphone. As soon as I have the microphone in my hand, I'm fine. Then everybody has to listen to me, which is great.
Right. Yeah. So are you, I mean, I know this is a bit of an overused thing now, but are you an introvert basically? Is that what you are at heart?
I mean, kind of. I think one of the reasons social media is so good for me and has been so good for me and I've enjoyed it is because I can have connections with people, but it's very arm's length. And if I want, I can just turn off the screen and I can kind of like back away for a bit and then come back. I said to a friend recently that I'm readjusting to life post pandemic and actually being in person with people, and someone will say something to me and I'll go, ah, crap, I have to answer right now, don't I? I can't think about something witty to respond. I just have to respond now. So that's been an adjustment. So that's, yeah, I wouldn't say I'm an introvert, but I would say that I have social anxiety for sure.
Yeah. And it's interesting because as we've been emerging from the pandemic and more things have been happening in person, I've realized how I didn't really miss that, you know, like I'm just as happy to talk to people on Zoom. And I know a lot of people hate it and they can't wait to be back together, but I'm honestly not one of them. I just, I'm comfortable talking to people from the safety of my own space.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Like if this whole podcast right now goes pear-shaped, I'll just turn you off and I'll go upstairs.
Exactly.
It'll be fine.
Yeah. 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 But I'm actually like, no kidding. I'm actually more comfortable doing this than if you and I were sitting in a studio together.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's a different energy from being together. And I get that when you're performing as such, and I call podcast recording performing, there's an energy you get from being in the same environment as someone. You're feeling the same things, and you get, it also gives you something, a shared experience to sort of connect on. But you're right. I mean, I think technology now has gotten to a point where it's like, it's not entirely walkie-talkie anymore. It's not sort of in-out communication. We can talk in a regular conversational manner, in a conversational pace and tone and beat. And it's just as good. Yeah, no, I mean, without the technology, it would be horrible. I can't imagine if the pandemic had happened like 10 years ago. It would have been awful. Yeah. It would have been horrible.
Yeah, and I don't know what people would have done. I guess a lot of like conference calls, right? With people on speakerphone.
God,
and stuff.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
That's the only thing worse than meeting people in real life is conference calls.
Yeah.
Conference calls are the devil's work. They're horrible. They're absolutely terrible because you can't tell who's talking. Usually when you talk to, like, if I'll get conference calls from agencies, and the agencies will call and they've set the conference call, you know, those little triangle speaker things, somewhere at the other end of the boardroom and probably hidden under some coats. And then they can hear me fine. I can't hear a damn word they're saying. And it's like they're talking over each other. No, it's okay, Barbara. You go ahead. You go ahead. No, John's going to take over now. I have no idea what... Are you okay with that, Stuart? I don't know what you said.
Exactly. Yeah, and not to go too far down this rabbit hole, but I was thinking the other day about how if Zoom hadn't happened, like if Zoom hadn't come along at just the right time, I mean, it was, you know, really just in time. I wonder if governments and businesses would have made other decisions during the pandemic because maybe they would have felt more pressure to bring people back together sooner because it wasn't like Zoom provided people the opportunity to actually maintain their employment from their homes, which maybe they wouldn't have been able to do otherwise.
I totally agree. I think that they would have just been forced to. I think that things would have ground to a halt, whereas now, you know, that sort of dream of telecommuting is now it's like, well, yeah, you can actually just do that. It turns out you don't have to sit in an office for 8 hours to get something done that you could do on your laptop in your pajamas at home, and you still get the same output, if not better. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What's your secret talent?
My secret? I don't have a secret talent, because if I had a talent that I hadn't shown you yet, I'd find a way to monetize it. I would probably. So every talent I have is monetized. Yeah. I have no secret talents.
Okay. What's your boldest prediction for the future?
Things are going to get better. Unequivocally. Absolutely. Yeah. I feel really strongly about the fact that it's so hard to get caught up in the doom and gloom and horridness of the news cycle, whether it be climate change and political stuff or whatever, pandemic stuff. It's like things will get better. And I think it'll get better because one of the parts of the human condition is that you can't not learn from experience. Even though some people are really good at trying to not learn from experience, the vast majority of people, and thankfully a lot of smart people, learn from experience. And therefore, just based on that, things will get better.
I'm glad you said that. And I was just listening to something. I've read some of the work of Steven Pinker before, and he argues that there's never been a better time to be alive than right now. And that will continue to be true every year going forward. Of course, there are moments that happen. There are bad things. There are natural disasters and all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But by any measure, human life has never been better than it is right now, even with a pandemic going on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we romanticize, you know, thinking back even to like, you know, the 1920s and stuff. And I've been referring to this time period as the Roaring Twenties 2.0 coming up. And it's kind of like, we're not going to go into the Depression. We're not going to go into World War II. It's okay. We've done those things. Just like the 1920s weren't like the 1820s. But you kind of romanticize the old times and think, well, it would have been so great to be back in the 20s and all the except. No, it wouldn't. It would have been horrible. You could have got measles or something, or polio was coming up or whatever. And you think back to even further, like, well, it would be great to be in like the, you know, medieval times. Like, no, that'd be even worse. That'd be terrible. No, this is a pretty cushy time in history. I'm okay with it.
Yeah. We've got indoor plumbing, we've got anesthetics, you know, we've got medical science, like,
Yeah, those are your shopping list for a good life, really. Indoor plumbing and anesthetics. That's exactly. Antibiotics.
Yeah. If you were giving a commencement address, what would be your message?
My message would be, don't waste your time. That's a really generic sort of way to say it, but don't waste your time. If you have opportunities and they're calculated risks, meaning that they're not stupid opportunities. If you have calculated risks you can take, you should take them. If they are going to make you happy or make you feel like you're moving forward. I think it's too easy to get lost in the idea of just exchanging time for money. And it's like, that's all you've got is your time. So if there's something you want to do, you should be doing it.
Nice. What has been the greatest turning point in your life so far?
Greatest turning point. I mean, there's been lots, to be honest, but if I picked one, I'd probably focus on August of 2013. I made a video on Vine, which is this looping video platform, and it took off and was like super crazy successful. It was being copied and redone by like TV shows and stuff. And about a month after that, Disney contacted us and said, we're going to pay you thousands of dollars to make videos for us. And I was like, oh, you can do this for a living? This sounds pretty great. So that's probably the biggest turning point in my life was when that video took off. It was like, oh, okay, now that like 200,000 people have watched this in less than 12 hours, this is something. This is something. I don't know what it is yet, but it's something.
So yeah. Definitely then. And what was the video?
It was Put Your Finger on the Screen. The app Vine, I'd done a few videos and I joined Vine to sort of like for my own mental health, basically to sort of find a reason to laugh each day. And I would create these stupid videos with a plastic Chewbacca doll that I had since I was about 12. And because it'd be ridiculous to have a grown man making videos on his own, right? That's obvious. You need to have a co-star. And then Chewie and I would do these stupid videos and people would start to comment on them. I'd get sort of 30 likes, 50 likes. And then I realized that on the Vine app, if you put your finger on the screen of the app, you could actually move the video up and down while it was playing. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be fun if you did that while the video is playing and it looked like you were affecting what was happening in the video? So it'd be like, you know, move your finger up and down and I'm spilling a glass of water or things are falling over or something's getting broken or whatever, that type of thing. And we did a bunch of them, but that first one was like, it went absolutely crazy. It was just nuts. I went from about 3,000 followers on Vine to over 100,000 within like a few days. It was like, there was like panic stations in our house when it took off that night.
Yeah.
It was like, because I think we were all kind of that really terrible year from 2008 to 2013. Lucky enough, Shannon and myself are quite entrepreneurial and can recognize some opportunities, even weird ones, or at least smell them a little bit. And, that night it was like, okay, we have to do something. We have to, like, I don't know what this means. I don't know how we make money from this, but this, we've got a lot of people who are interested in what we're doing. This must mean good things. So let's keep going with that.
Yeah. Well, good for you for thinking that way at that moment. We'll talk more about the trajectory in a few minutes, but sure. you turned that into an opportunity. And just curious, how many followers on Vine do you have now?
Well, Vine shut down. Oh, thanks so much for that, Mark. I really appreciate that, bringing that very, very sore point up to me. Yeah. I had 1.2 million followers on Vine. Isn't that crazy?
Wow. Yeah. And then it just vanished, basically, right?
Poof. It all just went away.
Yeah. But you're doing okay on some other platforms instead. So
a lot of crying, but other than that, I'm fine.
What has been a recent epiphany for you? Is there something about which you've changed your mind or some recent discovery you've made?
I think a recent epiphany I had was that I have to acknowledge my own like anxiety. I have to acknowledge that, as opposed to just thinking, wow, God, why can't I focus right now? Why can't I get it together? Why am I so nervous? And then realizing, oh, I think I'm super anxious about this. And then once I realized that, it was kind of like, okay, well, now I can just deal with the anxiety and not think it's connected directly to my ability to perform, not meaning like on stage necessarily, but meaning like perform, like write, record, you know, and edit and all that kind of stuff, work in general. So my anxiety, the epiphany was realizing my anxiety was separate from my ability to do those things. And then once I did that, it was like, okay, now I can just like work on getting rid of my anxiety or shrinking it or controlling it and then not worry about the other stuff.
That's really important, because you can conflate the two things otherwise, right? And then
totally.
you're connecting your work with the anxiety, and that and it becomes the same thing, and a negative experience, instead of saying, okay, I can move one of them over to the side, deal with it on its own, and then get on with the other one, right?
Yeah, it's very much easy to do. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, if you're a contractor or a construction worker or something like that, and you had a hammer in your bicep, you'd be like, ah, I'm terrible at hammering. It's like, no, you have a hammer in your bicep, or you have a screwdriver in your bicep. What a terrible image. Sorry about that. But that idea where it's like, this is separate from your ability. This is separate from your skill set and your skill level. This is just something else that's just making it difficult to do that. So treat it separately, deal with it separately, and just keep doing what you're doing.
Is there a book that's had a big impact on you, a book that you're most likely to recommend to other people?
Yeah, lots of books. But I mean, I think the for my own peace of mind, I'll often think of like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I know it sounds funny, but I mean, it seems like just, oh, it's just a stupid space story. But there's so much that Douglas Adams made fun of current norms and protocols and nonsense stuff that happens in the world, and the ridiculousness of life in general. That he just kind of painted in this sci-fi story. So yeah, I like that one because it reminds me that things are stupid and that I'll be fine.
Yeah, nice. All right, Stuart, thank you for answering those questions. We're going to take a short pause, and then we will continue digging deep with Stuart Reynolds. We're just going to take a quick break so I can tell you a little bit more about the presenting sponsor of Digging Deep, ZenBooks. ZenBooks is Canada's go-to cloud accounting firm. They are not your typical accounting firm. I know the founders, Colin and Eric. I've worked with them for several years. And here's why I think you should consider working with them too. First of all, they bring a fresh, unique, modern approach to what is a very old-fashioned industry. These guys were working remotely and in the cloud long before it became cool. ZenBooks also uses technology to your advantage. I think this is really important. They give you the tools and analysis you need to monitor your business in real time. That's so valuable right now when everything changes so quickly. Yes, they're a virtual accounting firm, but that doesn't mean they're offshore, and it doesn't mean they're inattentive. ZenBooks combines the efficiency and effectiveness of a cloud accounting service with all the benefits that you'd want from a trusted advisor, high-level advice, and strategic support. Now, here's what I think is going to happen if you work with ZenBooks. You'll probably start out taking advantage of their cutting-edge cloud accounting solutions, but in the long run, I think you'll stay with them because of their strategic guidance and problem-solving. Among their core values, they specifically list being candid and proactive. Isn't that exactly what you want from a trusted advisor? Look, even if you're already working with an accountant or a bookkeeper, or you have some accounting staff on your team, I think you should still talk to ZenBooks and learn more about their tools and their expertise. Check out ZenBooks at zenbooks.ca. That's zenbooks.ca. Digging Deep is all about helping you make better decisions, and so is Abacus Data. Most leaders struggle to connect with and engage their audiences. Why is that? It's because they aren't sure how they think and feel and how they will react. Abacus Data can give you the strategic insights you need to make better decisions and to make them confidently. Here's a good example. A major national union was recently negotiating a new agreement for its thousands of members. This had the potential to be a very difficult process. There were many competing interests. So they brought in Abacus Data to conduct thorough and detailed research of their members to learn exactly where they stood, what they were thinking, what they wanted. And as a result, they were able to secure a strong new deal that was accepted overwhelmingly in a national vote. Abacus Data helps all of its clients understand what's really happening in the minds of their employees, clients, and stakeholders. They help them avoid costly blind spots. And they're really good at what they do. In fact, Abacus Data was one of the most accurate pollsters in the 2019 Canadian federal election. Make the one decision that will improve all of your other decisions. Let Abacus Data help you move forward with confidence and clarity. Go to abacusdata.ca. That's abacusdata.ca. Stuart, thank you again so much for being on the podcast. I'm really excited for our conversation. And I have to say, you know, I've been watching your videos for a long time. And then, of course, to prepare for this, I started researching a little more and watching interviews with you. And the more I learn about you, the more I like. And that's, you know, that's not always the case with people who are, especially people who are doing what you're doing, which is posting stuff online, right? And the sense I get is that you're just this nice Canadian guy from Stratford, Ontario, who kind of stumbled into this space, and you're doing your thing, and it's very authentic, and you're not trying to be something you're not, which is so rare on the internet. So I really admire that. I feel like there's a lot of posers on social media, and that's not how you come across.
I think it's very easy to not be a poser and an Instagram model when you start doing this at the age of 43. I think it's very easy. I think that's a big part of, I mean, I appreciate the kind words. It's so lovely to hear that. So thank you. But I think, you know, when I started doing social media in 2013 as a full-time gig, I was 43 years old. And, you know, I thought I'm getting away with something. This is crazy. Cause we'd go to these social media conventions and conferences, and I'd consume a lot of social media, and I'm a fan of a lot of social media creators, and I would meet them and I'd be like, oh my God, it's so nice to meet you. Oh dear God, you're 18 and I am 43. All right. Tell your mom and dad I said hi. We'll see you later. So I think I felt always kind of a bit of an outsider, perpetual outsider, which I think is my comfort spot. And I feel like I'm fortunate. Like it's not like I've used social media as like a stepping stone. It's like, I don't want to be an actor. I don't even want to be a comedian. It's not like I'm using it as to get somewhere else. It's like, wow, I can just get up and make stuff. It's like I'm SCTV, except I get to do it from my house in Stratford, which is great.
Yeah. And do you think that's perhaps an ingredient to your success, is that you're not this 22-year-old kid? Like, I mean, you're producing all this stuff, and you've got a totally different sort of image and brand and look than a lot of the people who are producing content on social media, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'll tell you a really quick story. I had a really interesting meeting with, I got an email saying request for meeting with agent in Los Angeles. And I responded, request granted by social media darling in Stratford, Ontario. And then I went to this Zoom meeting, and there was two guys in Beverly Hills, and they were interested in what I was doing. And they were sort of thinking about pitching like 30-minute shows to Netflix and all this kind of stuff. And one of the guys out of nowhere, he just looks in the camera and he goes, "You're no Brad Pitt." And I was like, ow, that's a little hurtful, but it's pretty accurate. And then the next guy says, "But the thing is, no one should want what you're offering, but for some reason they do." And I was like, well, are you trying to beat me down? Is this like a boot camp, a Hollywood boot camp? But I mean, the thing is that they're both right, sadly, but, there's a weird aspirational quality, I think, that I have. And I'm aware of that. In that, for a couple of angles, one is for people who are younger, and I have this weird collection of people who are fans who are 18 to 24. So when I get recognized, it's lots of young people, which is like sort of early 20s, which is interesting. But they aspire, they have this aspirational quality about me where they look at me and they go, well, he's old and he's really close to death, but he seems to be having a good time. And then people who are my age and older are like, wow, he's almost dead like me and he's still having a good time, which is great. And then I think the final one, which I've been really aware of this past couple of years, is being this white middle-aged guy in the suburbs. I think I can, you know, I'm a schlub. I'm just a dude. I'm a guy who's like, doesn't really want to cut his lawn, but then really enjoys it when he does. And, you know, sits in his back deck and has beer and all that kind of stuff. But if I can go out and I can kind of speak to issues or address issues and kind of show other middle-aged white suburban schlubs that it's okay, don't worry about it, you'll be fine. And just don't be a horrible person. Then that's kind of, that's a good thing for me to be able to do.
Yeah. And so like for people our age, and maybe this is not something that resonates with younger people, but for people our age, what strikes me about this is, you know, before the internet, there wasn't the opportunity to do all of this, right? Like there were a handful of little jobs you could get. Like if you got to be a writer on a comedy show like Saturday Night Live or something, then you got to have an outlet for all this creativity. But what the internet has unlocked, and I have friends who had other jobs and still have other jobs, but they post hilarious stuff on Facebook, or they post some music they write on Facebook, and people get to see it. And I find that amazing, because I just think about how 50 years ago there would have been all this creativity that would have reached very, very small audiences. So you would have had you know, somebody like you or me, we would have had desk jobs at an insurance company, and maybe we would have entertained 4 or 5 people with whatever material we created. And now with the internet, you can entertain tens of thousands of people, if not more.
Oh, and I think that's also coming at it, I think, from our age as well, like from a little older perspective, more mature perspective, or more experienced perspective, is realizing just like how incredible it is that you can have a machine in your pocket that can do phenomenal video recording, phenomenal audio recording. You can edit things on your phone and you can post it from anywhere, and it can go out to millions and millions of people just for free, essentially, which is phenomenal. I think back to like when I was doing music in my teens, and we would do demo recordings, and we might go into the studio and spend like $3,500 in a demo recording and then struggle to get 10 people to listen to it.
Yeah.
And I think now it's like, wow, I could, you know, I did a song last Christmas called Santa Better Wear an Effing Mask. And it's one of the better performing songs I've ever released. But what's hilarious is that it's gone out and it's now been like, it's gotten, you know, almost 1 million people have listened to it. And it's like, that's great. I'd have just been some weirdo with a cassette saying, hey, listen, play this cassette. You know, it would have been terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. People used to have to scrape money together to release a CD.
Oh my God.
Right.
That's how Brittle Star started. Brittle Star was a band name, and that was 2004. And it was like scraping together production money to record, and then to actually, even though we did a lot of home recording, but then to actually manufacture the CDs, and then working from there to like get it out to the retailers. It was a huge deal, as opposed to just, you know, here's the link, go find it, that type of thing.
So, you know, for all we criticize social media, I think there are benefits that we don't think about sometimes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I had one thing. There's a guy named Eric Garland in the States. He's from Missouri, and he's a former intelligence specialist, and he's an interesting guy. But I somehow roped him into being a guest host on our live stream, which happens on Fridays. And it's called The Morning Show Thing. And it's just myself and my wife. It's incredibly rigidly formatted like a kid's show. It just goes boom, boom, boom. There's different things that happen. Then we're out after 40 minutes, and people enjoy it, which is great. But my wife was away and I needed a co-host. And so he came in and remotely co-hosted. And we have this segment on the show called Fridge Friday, where people will send in pictures dependent upon whatever theme it is for that week. And so we're going through the pictures that day. And I think it was maybe hobbies or something like that. And a number of people sent in pictures of like their watercolors, their oil paintings. And afterwards, Eric said to me, you know, technology so often is used so cynically and so harshly and meanly, but sometimes it's just perfect for looking at other people's pictures of their paintings. And it's like, yes, it really is. Because now we all got to look at these paintings. We're like, that's nice. Good job. And everyone's supporting everyone. And it's really nice. So you're totally right. There's like huge benefits to social media. I mean, it's just the nature of humans that will also find the terrible stuff and exploit that too.
Yeah. So you mentioned the name. So Brittle Star was originally the name of your band, right? And then
it was going to be.
And I looked it up. It's some kind of fish, right?
it's a starfish. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was back in 2004. doing an album, and because I decided I was 34 and I was like, I just, if I don't do this album, I'll never do it. And I ended up roping in help from this guy named Stephen Duffy, who was like one of the founding members of Duran Duran and Tintin and all that kind of stuff. And he would help me write these tunes and produce these tunes remotely. He was down in Los Angeles doing stuff with Robbie Williams. And this is all just me name dropping.
And exactly.
But then it came to the time we were getting the album finished, and I was like, I can't release this under Stuart Reynolds. Like, no one's going to wear a Stuart Reynolds t-shirt. And so my eldest son had this Marine Life book, and he's about 3 at the time. And we're going through it, and there's these starfish called brittle stars, and they're long and spindly, and they're gross, and they're the ugliest of the starfish, and they see through their tentacles and they defecate out of their mouths. And I was like, that's cool. And just jammed brittle stars together, took away the S at the end, just became brittle star after that. So that's where the name came from. And it was just, but I mean, the album was essentially me with some, like a couple people helping in general, but I did like 3 albums as brittle star. That first record was the most popular one, and had all of its songs were licensed by MTV for their Real World show. And then, which was great. It became evident that I should just switch into comedy the older I got. I saw some pictures of myself performing live, and I was like, I wouldn't go see me.
But then how did you end up using it as your handle going forward? Because now most of what you produce now is not in the music space. So yeah, you could just use your name for that. What made you decide to kind of hang on to the brand for that?
I think a couple of reasons. One, the most pragmatic reason is the fact that I had all the socials and all the domain names already. So it was like, great, I've already got these, and I've built up reputations, not reputations, but you know, over years I've maintained these accounts. And so that was of value to me. And then secondly, I was like, I've already built up a little bit of an audience who know me from the music. So why would I throw away even though it's a smaller audience, why would I throw that away and start from scratch again? I'll just keep that audience and see if they come along for the ride. Yeah, I know I was doing pop music about breakups before, but we want to hear some jokes. so that was kind of the thinking behind that. And thankfully it worked. I mean, it's now given me a position now where, you know, I can still release like, you know, regular music, and I can also release ridiculous music. And I can do the videos, and it's all under this sort of Brittle Star, umbrella, which is great because it kind of gives people an idea of what to expect. So like when I hosted 2 seasons of a show called Fast Health, where I drove supercars and stuff. And it was, people knew when it was Brittle Star, it was like, well, I kind of know what to expect. It's going to be slightly irreverent, but it's not going to be horribly offensive. And that's great.
Yeah. And I wonder, do you kind of have a set of rules or guidelines or principles that you follow with your content? Because it seems like you've found this sweet spot where you are edgy, but you're not, you know, you're not offensive, and where you still come across as this nice guy, even though you're, you know, even though you're taking on some, you know, you're especially with some of the stuff you did during the pandemic, you're kind of taking on, you know, the anti-vaxxers and the anti-maskers and all of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not really a rule of content creation, but it's kind of a guide for me. And it's best described as, you know, when you watch the movie National Lampoon's Vacation, except you watch it on television. So there's no boobs and there's the swearing's bleeped out. That's my guidance for creating content. But at the same time, I want to create stuff that can be consumed and shared widely. And you know what? Your grandma knows how, she knows the F word. She knows the F word. She doesn't need to hear it, but she knows I'm saying it and she knows what I mean. So I think that, and it has impact still. That's the goal, is to be able to have content that you can share widely. And I try to sort of think of it as the pub culture as well. Like, if you go to a British pub, it's like you'll go in there, there'll be old guys, there'll be every age range. There'll be like 17-year-olds getting an underage drink, and there'll be like all the way up to like the 98-year-old guy who sat at the bar for the past 60 years or 70 years. And you can tell a joke that they all laugh at, then that's a good joke.
Yeah, nice. So you've actually accomplished what millions and millions of people have set out to do, which is to generate a following on social media and make a living doing that. Just walk us through how that happened and kind of what you've learned along the way, because you're, you know, there are tons and tons of people who set out with this in mind and they, you know, inevitably there's only so much time and there's only so many eyeballs, and they might end up with 500 or 5,000 followers and they might make, a little bit of money, but not enough to quit their jobs. Right. So how did it happen for you?
I think I was very fortunate, first of all. I mean, luck always plays a part. I mean, luck on its own will show you the door and open the door, but it doesn't keep you in the room. So luck played a part in the fact that back in 2013, when I joined Vine, it was the week that Vine started. When we blew up on Vine, it was the end of 2013. But there was also a whole raft of people on YouTube and other platforms at the time that were all kind of coming up, and all kind of realized, oh, and I think technology played a part in that. I was talking about this recently, actually, about how there was a switch from 3G to 4G, which meant that people could suddenly consume videos while they were anywhere on their phones. That made a huge difference. It suddenly meant that, as opposed to just being, you know, at home on their Wi-Fi or at school or on their laptop or desktop, they could suddenly be in the grocery store and watching videos. That made a huge difference. So that kind of played a massive part in it. That said, again, that's kind of the luck part of it. And luck gets to the door and opens the door, but doesn't keep you in the room. The keeping you in the room part is about sustainability and trial and error. So trying to find, like, the great thing about digital media and digital content creation, and the fact, as we were saying, you know, back in the old days, if you wanted to create, you know, a video, you'd film yourself and then maybe hand out VHS tapes. And that was very difficult. That's an expensive, timely process, a time-consuming process. Whereas now you can sort of mess around and create something and be like, I'm going to try this. And if it fails and flops, yes, the internet's forever. However, there's a ton of flops out there you'll never see in your life. So unless it's really offensively awful, in which case you shouldn't have done it in the first place. But if you're just trying something and it's not quite right, you pull it and then you just try the next thing. Or if you're brave, you just do it and go, it didn't work, and I just keep learn from that and do the next one and just keep it up, and who cares? There's always this worry about creating content on the internet of, like, what if I do this and it just, you know, it's out there forever and it's horrible? And it's like, well, first of all, as long as you're not being, again, offensive to an extreme, and just being hurtful and mean, racist, you know, whatever, misogynist, whatever, then you don't have anything to worry about. You're an idiot, so who cares? It's fine. Don't worry about it. Because you should be so lucky that people will find your video. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, exactly.
That's the thing, is that there's people who are trying desperately every day to get eyeballs on their videos. What makes you think your stupid video is going to suddenly get the attention of the internet and break the internet? It just probably won't. There's like a million stupid videos an hour probably going up that you'll never, ever see in your life. So it's trial and error, and it's sustainability, and that it's like, what can I do and how can I create quickly and easily? How can I lower the cost of production even further? And the cost meaning not just financial or fiscal, but meaning mental and physical and time costs of creating content. And if you can do that, then you can kind of just keep building and keep on going. And you hopefully get lucky and you hopefully find an audience. And when you find that audience, you try to give the audience kind of what they want, but also kind of lead them down different paths. It's really hard. It's even more hard now with algorithms. The algorithms, like on TikTok, for example, is fantastic. It's a great algorithm for the user because it serves you up stuff you're like, oh, okay, I would never have found this otherwise. That's exciting. The problem with the algorithm is that it's basically your idiot self curating your own content.
Right.
Sort of like, yeah. You're reacting to things and engaging with things, and the algorithm goes, you like this, we'll give you more of that. As opposed to going to an old video store and it's like, recommended by Chad. It's like, well, I trust Chad. So there's no outside third party curation happening. It's just all happening by you, whatever you're clicking and engaging with. So that makes things harder. That means as a creator on TikTok, it's hard because you might get one video. I had a video a week and a half ago that's got like 500,000 views, and then the next video has like 3,000. So it's like, and I've got 160,000 followers. So you think they'd all see it, and they just don't. They just don't see it.
Yeah, and so it strikes me that the lesson in that is similar to what we've heard before about, you know, people producing music or stand-up comedians or people, you know, great writers, is that we observe them when they become famous and they have this sort of breakthrough moment. But in behind that was all this work we didn't see, right? And that you know, that you're going to small nightclubs and doing your routine, and some jokes are working and some aren't, and you drop the ones that aren't and you add new ones, and then finally you get an act and you happen to go in front of a slightly larger audience and somebody there notices you and invites you to a slightly bigger venue, and it just all, and then, you know, we discover you, the most of the world discovers you when you get on one of the late night talk shows or something like that. Yeah. But there was all this work that went in beforehand, right?
Yeah, for sure. There's, I mean, like everything, you know, as someone had said before me, life is marketing. That's exactly what it is. It's a case of, you know, if people don't know what you're doing, they don't know what you're doing. So in relation to social media, you make a video that gets 10 views. It's maybe because only 10 people saw it. Maybe that's 100 people that really, 100% of the people really enjoyed it. If you can get those 10 people to turn into 10,000 people or 10 million people, then you're like, oh, I've made it. And it's like, I'm doing the exact same thing I was doing before. So it's all marketing, and marketing in the sense, like, I often refer to the band Radiohead, and they're very, you know, experimental rock band, and it's amazing stuff that they do. I'm not a huge fan, but they do amazing stuff. I'm well aware of that. And I call their song Creep their idiot on-ramp. Their song Creep was like their only real big hit. Yeah. And it was a huge wide net that made everyone go, whoa, look at this band Radiohead. And then they came out with, you know, Kid A or something after that. And it's something really weird, like Paranoid Android and all this plastic trees. And it's like, okay, you've lost about sort of 60% of those people, but you had so many people interested in you and what you were doing. That's still a lot of people who are interested. Now you can actually create more stuff and then start building people in. So it's all marketing. You can't just forge ahead and do exactly what you want, and if no one likes it, go, well, I don't care, I got to keep doing it till people like it. You can't do that. You have to do something that people like first, or at least occasionally, to hook them in and then expand your net. And then from there, you can kind of hopefully bring them on a path where it's like, well, listen, if you like that stuff, I'm also doing this stuff too, and kind of grow it from there.
Yeah. And can you explain, for those people who don't kind of understand how it all works, how you monetize what you do and how you think about that side of it, and how that whole business side of social media and video production and all of that works? I'm not asking you how much money you make, just how it works. Yeah.
No, I'll tell you, it's what's interesting about monetization. A couple of things that are interesting about it. One is, I mean, obviously people are aware that people can make lots of money off of YouTube, and you certainly can make lots of money off YouTube. But it's very difficult because YouTube's not a social media platform. It's a repository of videos. It's a destination. It's a search engine to find videos. So monetization on YouTube has been a very small part of our revenue. Starting with people would used to download my Vines from the Vine app, and they would make compilations of my Vines and then post them on YouTube. And I signed to a company in LA called Collab, and one of their services that they provide is digital rights management. And so they would just go and they'd have a team of people that would go out and like find Brittle Star's best vines that would have like 25 million views. And they'd be like, all right, he gets that money. So that's how that would be monetized that way. The other stuff, unfortunately, like Twitter is monetized, which is great. So I'll do videos on Twitter, and if they get, if they're appealing to advertisers, then ads get stuck on the front of them, which is fine because it helps pay the bills. It's good. And what's interesting about Twitter, though, is that, and for a lot of them, like Twitter and Facebook, is that any video I did this past year and a half that mentioned COVID or vaccines or pandemic were demonetized. So I didn't make any money off those. So there goes a few videos out there that have well over a million views. It's like no money for those whatsoever. So that's been frustrating. So that kind of...
And is that because of the sort of the sensitivity around it, the idea that...
Yeah, I mean, I kind of understand it. I mean, you don't want to have a video called I'm Tired of the Pandemic. And it was quite a serious video. And it's got well over a million views. It's not really funny. It's just, it's about me saying and realizing, you know, but realizing that no matter if you're an anti-vaxxer or if you're a sane person, then... we're probably both tired of the pandemic. We're probably both tired of this. So we can agree on that. So it's kind of talking about that. And I can appreciate the fact that it'd be like, you know, Visa is not going to be like, hey, let's put an ad in front of that. That'd be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Get people all jazzed up for the new Visa card and then just talk about how the pandemic is killing us all. Not a lot of advertising appeal to that one. So I appreciate that. And I totally understand that. But I mean, our big bread and butter, though, is like branded content currently. And still, I mean, it's slowly changing. Branded content was, we'll get hired by people I was on contract creating social media content for Rogers for 3 years. Awful company. I can say that now because I'm no longer in compete. But they're not as, I mean, they're no, there's some people, there's lovely people who work at Rogers, but they're just as good as you think they are. There you go. That's a better way to say it.
Yeah. Their board is fantastic too.
Their board of directors. Yeah, I think I've seen their Succession. That's a great show.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'll do that. I'm very grateful for all the brands, including Rogers as well, because they were actually very nice, usually. So we'll do branded content for people like Rogers or Walmart or Best Buy or that type of thing, where they will come to me and say, here's a campaign, here's our messaging. Can you create something that you would create and then include this messaging in your video and our brand? And that's, for a long time, has been our main source of revenue. And then more recently, in the past year, we started a line of apparel and merch called Peace Love Canada, based on the fact that I used to sign off, and I still do sometimes, sign off all my tweets with the emojis Peace Love and the Canadian flag. And that's now quickly become about 40% of our revenue, which is amazing.
Wow.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, because there's t-shirts and I know you had masks. And
So no more masks, but the hats and t-shirts and sweatshirts and stickers and keychains and all this kind of stuff. And we try to source everything from Canada. There's some stuff that's really hard to do, but most of the stuff, weird stuff, is from Canada. Like the keychains are from Canada, which is bizarre. It's like a small company in Quebec that makes motel keychains. Isn't that weird? Whatever, that's great. We're happy to find them. I had a very, very, very wealthy friend one time say to me, she's a super rich performer. And I said, how do you make money? I was like 18. I was like, how do you make money? And she said, I have my finger in a lot of pies. I was like, I get it. Okay, good.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it is. It's just kind of like, well, this is only worth, you know, X number of dollars per month, but it's a nice part and doesn't take much to maintain. So let's keep it going with the other 8 things we've got going on as well, as opposed to just saying, I make videos, that's all I have to do, and I get paid millions of dollars. And we know people who do that, but I'm not one of them. I have to make videos and then do a whole bunch of other stuff as well.
But those pieces all fit together too, right? They're all part of the same. It's not like you're making videos and then you've got a hot dog stand or a they're all connected to each other.
Yeah, unless it was a Brittle Star hot dog stand or something.
Yeah,
you could serve starfish. That'd be good.
Starfish on a bun.
Stick. On a stick, I think it'd be great. The little, it'd be all sort of legs would be out and stuff, or tentacles. Are the little kids crunching on them? They could be caramelized for fall fairs. They all play into the brand, and that's kind of been the game plan. I mean, there's no real game plan because I don't know what's happening. The landscape changes so rapidly. But my only game plan is to maintain the Brittle Star brand so that whenever you see the Brittle Star name connected with something, you're like, okay, I kind of know where this is, what this is going to be. I kind of get an idea. It might be, it could be a book. It could be a video. It could be a song, or it'd be like, I kind of know what it's going to be like though.
Yeah.
And that's kind of been the focus.
But I think you're also sort of, it seems to me you're open to whatever comes your way, right? Like you're ready to be fluid and kind of adapt to the changing marketplace, and you're saying yes to a lot of things because who knows where they could lead, right?
That's exactly it. I think you have to be as fluid as possible now because technology is changing things so rapidly. You can't just ignore technology. I would used to make fun of a friend of mine. It'd be like, I'm not going to get a social media account or Facebook account. And I was like, okay, then give up your push button phone too. Like this is, we're all heading in this way. So let's go. And again, it goes back to the answer to one of the rapid questions. It's like, don't rail against your own successes. You might find, if you're fluid, you might find success in a thing that you're like, I didn't want to do this. Like with me, with social media, making videos on my phone initially, it was like, this is Who wants to do that? I mean, it sounds fun, but back in 2013, it's like, I don't know if I want to do that. It's not really what I'm aiming for. I never dreamed of doing it. But if it's successful and you're having fun, then don't rail against it. Just enjoy it and see what you can make of it.
And the sponsored content that you do, you're basically producing something that you might have produced anyway, but then you're framing it into a message from a commercial sponsor, right?
Yeah, that's the nicest way to put that, for sure. Yeah, I mean, that's the ideal way. That's kind of like the biggest branded piece we ever did was for KFC, explaining Canada Day to Americans. And I think it's like 65 million views. It was the biggest branded video in the world in 2017. It beat out Nike by like 10 million views that year. And it was a real case of like, here's a video I'm going to make anyway. How can we include the brand? And that worked out great. It doesn't always work that way. Sometimes brands get really freaked out and worried, and they'd like, oh, we got to make sure all of our messaging's in there. And it's like, and my question is always like, what's the last ad that you shared on social media? You know, you just don't, unless they're really good and they entertain first.
Yeah. And so I think there's a lesson in that, because not just with the sponsored content, but with the stuff that you've done during COVID around getting the vaccine, and you did some stuff recently about getting the flu shot and that kind of thing, that I wonder if people are trying too hard to communicate in the wrong ways, right? Like you need to get people's attention and then deliver a message rather than just, bombard them with information and think education is what's going to win the day, right? You need to grab people's attention, entertain them, and then slide in a line or two, and that's all you're going to get, right?
Absolutely. And that's the most potent way to do it. That's the best recipe for success is to do it that way. You have to, it's transactional, especially in social media. Any ad on social media that people watch, they have chosen to watch the ad. Even if it's a pre-roll ad, they're sitting through it. And if they're watching it, they've chosen to sit through it and watch it. And certainly any branded content for me, it's like, if you're choosing to watch the KFC ad or the Best Buy ad or whatever, I'm doing an ad for Cal Tire, which comes out in a couple of weeks. It's like, if you choose to watch that ad, if you're watching that ad, you have chosen to watch that ad. How many other ads do you choose to consume anywhere in any other medium? You just don't. Even in newspapers, if you want to consume, you have to get the attention. It has to get your attention first before you see it and read it and consume it. Same with television ads. People are usually scrubbing through the television ads now, people who still watch television. And you just can't, you have to entertain first and sell second. You have to. I'm a huge believer in that. Even right back to, I was talking to, doing a thing for United Way thing in Burlington at some point, and I think in a couple of weeks or a few weeks. And I was saying, I'm a huge believer in the idea that you can't just say, here's something good, come consume this information.
Yeah.
You have to be like, here's something fun. I'm going to make your decision to spend time with us worth it, and you're going to get something out of it. And then while you're here, I'm going to sneak in a couple of lines, as you said, that it's going to make you walk away going, oh yeah, we should maybe donate more or help that or whatever, that type of thing. That's the key. That's the way to do it.
Yeah. And I think that applies to, as you say, charitable messages, public policy, public health, all of those kinds of things. Instead of just, we're going to educate, we're going to share a bunch of dry information and assume that everybody wants to hear it and they're going to accept it that way. Right. So,
I felt terrible for Dr. Tam when she was, I love Dr. Tam. She's great. She's incredibly smart and all that kind of stuff. But her messaging was just like, why is no one talking to her about this? Why is no one telling her that this, like, you can't just say, here's some scary here. You know, the scary thing that's happening. Here's more scary information about that. You have to find a way that's going to make people realize that it's important information, but you've got to find a way to make them think, okay, this is a nice, easy way to get in. This is a little, spoonful of sugar, basically.
Yeah. Do you feel pressure to keep producing great content, funny content? Like, does that after you get successful with this and then all of a sudden people are waiting for more and expecting more. And does that create some pressure for you?
Yeah, it does to an extent, and it certainly builds up every now and then, but I'm getting better at dealing with that. One of the lessons I learned in the past few years when things started to really kind of move, like on Twitter, for example, is I would do a video or that would get, I don't know, like 400,000, 500,000 people watching it on a Thursday. And then people on Monday would be like, is there no new video? Yeah, are you doing a video about this yet? And it's like, I just did a video like back then. I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
And I'll do like, normally I'll do sort of like 2 to 4 videos a week. And realizing that there's just this never ending desire to consume content. Like it's just, yeah. It's never ending, not a desire, even desire, but it's like this never ending spot for content to be consumed. And especially people like your content and they feel they need it and they rely on it. And it's, you know, you feel the pressure of having to do it. Is it all great? I'm trying to get over that idea. I'm trying to get over the idea of like, is it all great? No, some of it'll be crap. It'll be like watching SNL and going, well, that, you know, five of those sketches were terrible. That other one was hilarious. Or, you know, watching SCTV where it's like, this is stupid, but the rest of the show is gold or whatever. Or it's like Paul McCartney. That's right. I'll compare myself to a Beatle. but it's like Paul McCartney's temporary secretary. It's like you need a temporary secretary every now and then just so that Paul can clear his head. And right. Then he can go back and he can write another Hey Jude or something.
Yeah. And what is the process? Like, do you just do stuff when you have ideas or do you have like a schedule that you follow that you're trying to produce a certain amount of content every week or how does it work?
No schedule. It's really because this, a lot of the stuff I'm doing is very current events, zeitgeist, weather-based. if I shoot outside, it has to be, you know, like I did a video where the first snowfall is a lie. And we had quite a bit of snow in Stratford about a week ago. And it's all gone now. But that was that panic that sets in where I'm sitting there having my coffee in the morning going, oh, it's a beautiful winter wonderland. Oh, crap, I better film a video right away.
Yeah.
So that's... there's no real set schedule. It's kind of like, you have to do this, you have to do this now. I did a video about if you may remember, if you're in Ontario, the Pickering Nuclear Power Generating Station sent out a warning, Amber Alert type thing in error, test one sent out to the public. And that went out at like 7:38 in the morning. And then by about 9 o'clock, 9:30, I had a video posted because I was like, it has to happen now. This is when this is funny. It makes sure people are safe. Okay, everyone's no one's dead. Great. There's no actual nuclear emergency. Great. Now this is perfect to make fun of, and let's make fun of it. So yeah, there's no schedule, which is horrible and also great sometimes because it's kind of like I don't have to do anything this afternoon, but I might have to do like 3 videos.
Right. Yeah. And do you script them out in advance or?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're all. I started doing that about 4 years ago, where I would script things out, and I used to kind of like have an idea and then just kind of like wing different lines. For different takes, and it just took too long, and I would miss opportunities to be funny. One of the great things about writing down and scripting out comedy is that you get to really hone in on your word choices, and the right word can just make a line, if you know, compared to just not being able to think of it on the fly.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about the pandemic, and I think your audience really grew during the pandemic because of some of the material that you were creating during the pandemic. But I also heard you say that the pandemic's been tough on you, that you've struggled with it at times. What have you been going through?
I mean, I would go through these things called pandemic wobbles that I call them anyway, pandemic wobbles, where it would be like an afternoon or it'd be up to like a couple of days where I'd be like, can't do anything. I couldn't see an end in sight. It was basically just anxiety sort of kicking in. And that's been part of my journey. Not to get too new agey, but about going through this pandemic is realizing that I have to deal with my anxiety, or otherwise it's going to trip me up. So the pandemic was like, I used the videos as a little bit of a therapy for myself to like create this, how I was feeling, and then hopefully be able to find other people out there who could commiserate with me. And we could kind of all go, yeah, this is pretty horrible. And I think that's the thing that we don't quite really grasp yet, even, is apart from people that were directly affected, like sadly and tragically directly affected by COVID, meaning healthcare workers and people who lost family members. But the rest of us, I don't think we've really clocked in yet to just how dark the pandemic was. I think that, you know, I think the people who are the anti-vax, the anti-mask, the anti-lockdown, like anyone's pro-lockdown, which drives me nuts. I hate that. I'm anti-lockdown. Oh, yeah, so am I. That's kind of what we all try to get past. But I think that, you know, those, I think of those people, and then I think of like the you know, the realistic sort of pragmatic version of it's like, do you think that Disney World would shut down in Florida for no reason? You know what I mean? Like they shut down, and it's like, dear God, in Florida, they don't care. Obviously, there's terrible things that happen in Disney World. They just keep going. People get crunched up in the rides, and they're like, it doesn't matter, keep going. But then this happened, and it shut down. It's like, okay, it must be serious. This must be a serious big thing. And I don't think that we've properly taken in. I think there's going to be a couple of documentaries or films and stuff, and it's going to make people go, oh, yeah, that was pretty historically awful.
Yeah.
So for me, but the videos were kind of therapy and just realizing that you have to prioritize your own mental health, regardless of what that means to you personally, and take care of yourself. Because if you don't, you can't do anything and you can't help anybody else.
Great point. So is there... have you figured out, and do you know in advance which videos are going to do really well and which aren't, or is it a total mystery to you that the ones that take off and go viral are not the ones you expected to?
That's exact. The latter is very true. Okay. It's usually the ones I do and I think, oh yeah, this is going to go, this is going to be amazing. And they kind of sputter and it's like, damn it. And it's the other ones where I'm going, I don't know. Maybe we'll try and we'll see what happens. And it's usually those ones that really kind of take off. Every now and then I get tricked into thinking I'm like, oh yeah, this is going to be the one. This is going to be a good video. And then you put it out and it just doesn't have the reaction, doesn't resonate for whatever reason. So it's really hard to tell. You can't pick your hits is the line.
Right. What advice do you have for people who are content creators and want to be more successful at it?
I think you have to, my advice would be to enjoy what you're doing because you're going to have to do a lot of it. And if you want to turn it into a thing, it's a job. It's a full thing. There's friends of mine who are actors, very successful actors. And, they've had conversations that they've told me about where they've been like, well, we should do more like Brittle Star and do more of his videos. And then asking me what I do and then going, God, that's a lot of stuff. You're like constantly doing stuff. And it's like, yeah, it's a lot of work. I'm not saying that I'm digging ditches. It's certainly an easy job in that regard. But at the same time, it's like you can't just be like, I'm just going to throw up a video and it's going to go viral. It's just not how it works until you get to a certain level. And then even then it's like a pretty wobbly pedestal. It's my advice would be that you have to love what you're doing or at least really enjoy it enough. Not love what you're doing. You just have to enjoy it because you're going to do a lot of it.
Yeah.
And to not take it too personally when you get comments, because comments are worthless. Comments are the stupidest thing ever. Nobody needs to know what somebody in Idaho thinks about your video. Who cares? Watch it or don't watch it.
Yeah.
It's you wouldn't watch the TV, or even Netflix. You wouldn't watch The Office on Netflix and think, gosh, I wonder what someone in Illinois thinks of this episode. Don't care. I don't care what they think. I enjoy it. It's fine.
And they wouldn't add 10 minutes to the end of each episode where they just roll a bunch of comments.
No, comments.
Like,
exactly. Because yeah. It'd be ludicrous because like no one cares.
Yeah.
That's just the thing. It's I had a guy named Scott Stratton who's a marketing dude and he was like, I remember him saying that to the first time. He's like, comments are worthless. And I was like, oh, that's a bit harsh. And then I thought about it. I was like, oh, they kind of are. Like nice comments are nice. And occasionally I will engage a little bit, but for your own as a content creator, your own mental health and your own sustainability.
Don't read the comments. Yeah, don't read the comments.
Because who cares?
Yeah.
You know? Grace Dent is a writer in England, and she coined the term that the comments are the bottom half of the internet. And I thought that's exactly what they're.
Yeah. And especially because people don't even have to put their names on them, which I think is, you know, I always hate that having written newspaper columns, you write a column, you put your name, your pictures there. And then some guy, you know, who's got numbers and mixture of letters in his name gets to have, you know, the same, not necessarily the same amount of space, but they get to have, you know, some space on the website of the newspaper to offer their opinion, and they can say whatever they want, and we don't know who they are. Like, at least I'm admitting who I am when I'm sharing my opinion, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think that I long for the days of the letter to the editor, because if you had an opinion, it could be crazy, but you had to commit to it. You have to commit to that opinion by sending it in, by buying a stamp, by all that kind of stuff. And
signing your name.
And signing your name. And I mean, some newspapers, our local paper, used to, like, you'd have to have your address printed as well, which is terribly dangerous. But your address would be printed along with your letter to the editor as well. And it'd be like full accountability. This is what I think of this issue. I mean, I'm so glad the CBC is no longer allowing comments on their Facebook posts and stuff. It's like, and website posts. Like, why? What is this adding to this story about Afghanistan? What is some dude in Richmond Hill going to tell me that's not being discussed in this story? It's dumb.
Yeah. Just a couple of final questions, Stuart, from the research that I was doing. You ended up getting invited to the White House at one point. How did that happen?
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
This is, maybe you can see it. I'm going to move my camera just briefly here.
Okay.
That is the invitation. Oh, where is it? That's the invitation to the White House right there.
Okay, so you've got a framed invitation to the White House among all your guitars and music equipment.
Exactly. It's down low as well. It was the Obamas though, so it should be a little higher. It's not too bad.
Yeah.
It wasn't like the Trump administration. It was 2016, and Prime Minister Trudeau was doing his first visit to the U.S. and the White House social media team wanted to invite some social media people who were Canadian. They were looking for a Canadian who had a decent U.S. audience. And the majority of my audience in 2016 was American. And so they contacted me and it was like, you're going to the White House. I was like, cool. That's amazing. So it was a ridiculous experience. So I was there for the arrival ceremony. I didn't get to go to the state dinner, but it was still fun. I got to stand like about 25 feet away from like Obama and Trudeau when they were speaking and on the White House lawn. And of course, just being there, it's like, this is weird. And then I spent the rest of the day in the Eisenhower building with the White House social media director and just sort of talking about stuff. And I've got like a package of M&Ms from Barack Obama, and it's just all really weird. But there's a theory, and I talked about this to someone recently as well. There's a theory that the world actually ended in 2012. You know, like the Mayan thing, the Mayan calendar.
Right.
They're like, oh, it's May 2012. It's going to all end. And it didn't. And we're like, it was just dumb. We'd have made a mistake, or it's stupid. It's probably just stupid. It was a theory that the world actually ended in 2012. And this is all just like a simulation.
Right.
And if you think about me being invited to the White House, it adds up, doesn't it?
It makes a lot more sense now.
It doesn't. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
There's Exhibit A.
Right. Exactly. Look at this Stuart, idiot.
Yeah, Stuart.
Got invited
Stuart
to the
Reynolds
why?
Got invented, invited to the White House. How could this be any sort of normal? Yeah.
There's a friend of ours who, a couple that we know and I've known for a very long time. And when I remember when that happened, and when anything prominent happens that I get to do, her response is always, but why? It's just Stuart. Why? So yeah, it would add up.
Good to have friends like that, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And then the last question I'll ask you, when I was, Googling you and stuff like that to just gather some information, I found that one of the most common questions asked about you on the internet is Stuart Reynolds related to Ryan Reynolds? And the funny thing is, you actually know Ryan Reynolds, although I don't think you're related. Yeah.
We're not related. Like about a year or so ago, he sent me a case of gin and then it arrived with a note, and the note said, I don't know if you and I are related, but I sure as hell hope we are, because I've been telling everyone that we are.
Wow.
And I was like, that's nice. And then we had a couple of like online chats, and then I was optioning a short story I'd written to a production company, and I asked him for advice, and we had this lovely telephone call where he'd like walk me through all the stuff. And I was like, this is great. He's like, he's a shy guy, but he's also phenomenally funny and incredibly successful, and really gets the notion of don't rail against your success. He's like, gin? Sure. Let's do that. Excellent. Oh, marketing company? Sure. Why not? Let's do that. So yeah, I have great admiration for him, but sadly we're not related, though we do refer to Uncle Bert and Aunt Debbie. So
yeah, maybe someday that the more common search is going to be, is Ryan Reynolds related to Stuart Reynolds?
Well, I mean, I think that's it seems like the natural progression. As I mentioned earlier, things are going to get really good. Things are getting better. And that's one of the ways we'll know things are getting better.
Yeah. Stuart, this has been amazing. I've been a big fan of your work for a while, and it's such a pleasure. And you confirmed what I said at the beginning, that you're essentially just a nice guy doing what you love from Stratford, Ontario. And I really admire that. I think it's terrific. So thank you for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. It was a great chat.
That's Stuart Reynolds, a.k.a. Brittle Star. I really enjoyed that discussion. You know, there are a lot of people on social media who are pretending to be somebody they're not. What I love about Stuart is his authenticity and how he uses that and his humor to be successful. Yes, he's strategic, but everything that he does is an extension of who he is. It's not some manufactured personality to get attention or likes. The internet has been good to him, but I think his ability to see what's going on in the world and turn that into appealing, accessible content is what has brought him success. And he's gone from a 3-year-old boy singing into an umbrella as his family cheered him on to a fully grown man who makes videos on the internet for a living. I'm impressed by that. And I've learned a lot from him. So I want to thank Stuart for sharing his story with us so we can understand the hard work that goes into making something that looks pretty easy, but isn't. If you enjoyed this episode of Digging Deep, I have a favor to ask. Please review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and please send it to a couple of people you think would enjoy it. That's going to help us reach more people and produce more great episodes. And one last thing, if you want to keep digging deep into topics and lessons like this, I have a weekly newsletter. I know you probably get tons of content in your inbox already, but this one is very quick. It's right to the point. It's 5 very short items, 1 paragraph each, that I've discovered each week, and it takes about 2 minutes to read. It's got some great lessons from experts that you can apply immediately. So subscribe, give it a try at letsdigdeep.com. That's letsdigdeep.com. And get ready for more great stories and powerful lessons on the next edition of Digging Deep. Thank you for listening.
Come on a journey like no other, where you will discover many roads that will lead you to a happier, healthier, and more stress-free life. And the beauty is, you don't need any vacation time for this adventure. The journey will come to you. Join Avery Rich on your very own journey into yoga. Along the way, she will demystify yoga poses and guide you into a yoga posture or short sequence, all in less than 15 minutes. You have nothing to lose but stress. The Journey into Yoga podcast. It's not for people who like yoga. It's for people who don't like yoga. Follow or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at averyrich.com.